think we have a few folks still filtering in here.
But have you not shown up?
So today we're having an informational hearing on Oregon's 529 plan. Over the last few months, there have been growing concerns over the operations of one sector of the state's 529 plan, which is designed to help parents save and invest money for their students to go to college. Today, as we begin legislative hearings on this issue, I want to make it very clear that the purpose of this hearing isn't to get anyone. This is no witch hunt. However, the legislature has an important responsibility in bringing the questions and concerns of the citizens onto the public record. We have a responsibility to provide significant oversight to state programs and activities, particularly in situations like this, where Oregon families have been hurt. Our goal today is to discover what really happened, who got hurt, and how might this legislature be able to protect parents who have invested in the program now and in the future? And how might we ensure that we have adequate controls in place to make sure that this never happens again? I know that members of the committee are interested in learning about the treasurer's internal investigation that was released yesterday to the 529 plan board. It's my understanding that Treasurer Ben Westland will join us at the end of the meeting to tell us more about the actions that the board took yesterday afternoon and about substantial new changes that he will be proposing to the Oregon 529 plan. I appreciate and thank former Treasurer Randall Edwards and Mr. Michael Parker, who are both here today, and their willingness to help us investigate these issues. And we also welcome Attorney General John Kroger, who will talk to us a little bit about the investigation that his agency is doing. I also want to thank the folks from the Oppenheimer Fund who have come today to tell their side of the story. Most importantly, we will hear from Oregon families who have been impacted by the plummeting value of their 529 plans. These are Oregon families who responsibly stepped up to the plate to save for their children's future. And today they're left wondering how they will make tuition payments for those students who are either in or nearing entry to college. In the end, what matters to me most is that we do not have a single Oregon child denied access to college because we have not done our part. This oversight hearing ultimately is not about the 529 plan or the Oppenheimer Fund. It is about Oregon families and Oregon students seeking a bright future by saving for college. Today we have a list of invited panelists. We had many people who were interested in testifying today. We simply were not able to accommodate everyone due to the time constraints, but you will find at your place for the record a letter from Bill Parrish, who has some concerns about this issue and has shared some questions with us. And it mentions some documents that are attached, and that has all been emailed to your office so that you can read further about those items. And with that, I would like to invite Randall Edwards and Michael Parker to the dais. Welcome.
Welcome, and thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, former state treasurer of Oregon. I would like to have this passed out as well, which is some background information that I wanted to make sure you had, one of which was a letter that I had sent to the leadership in anticipation of a hearing about some of the things that we had done and undertaken prior to this hearing. Again, I really want to say I appreciate this opportunity to discuss with you the Oregon College Savings Plan and to clear the air about some of the problems that have been highlighted in the media regarding one of the investment funds in the Oregon College Savings Plan. You need to understand what happened, for there is a great deal of public trust in this state program that was created about 10 years ago. I have been extremely troubled and am very sorry for what happened with the huge underperformance of Oppenheimer's core bond fund that began in September and ultimately lost nearly 38% of its value. It should not have happened, and it harmed our investors. However, I do want to be clear. The precipitous drop of this fund's value came suddenly, without warning, and we could not have prevented it. Further, we are not alone in this problem. Four other states rely on this fund in their college savings plans, and they too were impacted by it. I believe we were the first state, however, to flag this problem and to begin to act on it. As you recall, last week, Illinois' treasurer just announced his intention to sue Oppenheimer over mismanagement of this fund. Before I start to address some of the specifics about what happened this fall, I would like to give you a brief overview of the college savings plans, that is, these plans that are around in every state, and specifically Oregon's plan. I also want to touch on the hiring of Oppenheimer funds nearly 5 years ago. 49 states have a college savings program. These programs are unique investment vehicles specifically designed to achieve a number of public policy goals, and many of which the chair described. These goals relate to the special challenges states face in ensuring and increasing access to higher education and building a better educated workforce. In this perspective, these programs are directly linked to and are an important component of the overall higher education policies of each state. At their core, these programs are entities of the state with a different purpose and different set of goals than private sector investment vehicles. This fundamental aspect of the state-administered college savings plans must be kept in mind when examining the operation, oversight, and performance of the state plans. So why do states have these? As I said simply, families have been struggling to keep up with the growth of tuition expenses. Over the past 30 years, college tuition rates have increased by as much as 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation each year. During the same period of time, federal aid has shifted away from student grants to providing access to guaranteed student loans. Today, nearly 60% of all federal financial aid in the form of loans substantially increasing the number of college graduates who are faced with the burden of repaying enormous student loan debt upon entering the workforce. In the late 1980s, concern was mounting about the financial strains being placed on graduates and families, and states began to develop innovative programs designed to help families save for their children's college education. The original college savings plans were created by states including Florida, Michigan, Ohio, and Kentucky. To clarify the federal tax treatment of these programs, Congress eventually passed legislation creating Section 529 of the Internal Revenue Code in 1996. The bill created favorable federal tax treatment and spurred the development of savings plans nationwide. Today, more than 11 million children have become beneficiaries of 529 accounts with assets of more than $119 billion. So what is a 529 plan? Well, they come in two types. One, a prepaid plan, which are offered in 15 states, allow the participation of a purchase of a tuition based on today's rates and then paid out when the beneficiary is in college. The other is a savings plan, like the Oregon College 529 plan, which are offered in 49 states, including the District of Columbia, and our investment plans where people self-direct their investments, which typically consist of mutual funds. One of the tenets of the 529 laws requires states to pass their own legislation to attach themselves to Section 529 of the tax code. Further, the federal government requires state structure and oversight of the plans, which reside from higher ed boards to state treasurers. And in fact, the National State Treasurers Association oversees the national network of college savings plans. The important point to note here is that no financial institution can create a 529 plan on its own. The keys are with the states. In 1999, during my second term as a House member, the legislature passed almost unanimously, a bipartisan bill to establish a 529 college savings plan, which I had introduced and modeled after Delaware's plan. Oregon had experienced an enormous rise in college tuitions, and this was seen as a new tool to help families reduce the burden of sending children to college. The bill included a $2,000 state tax deduction for joint filers and put the state's chief investment officer, the state treasurer, in charge of the plan. There was also an oversight board established that included the treasurer, one person representing state higher education, another from private colleges, and two citizens. This model, in fact, is very similar in structure to the Oregon Investment Council. My first day as treasurer, just 8 short years ago, but it went quickly, I launched the Oregon College Savings Plan by opening up the first 3 accounts in the state for my 3 children. By mid last year, the plan grew to more than $1 billion, and I'm extremely proud of what we've achieved in a relatively short period of time. The way these plans work is pretty simple. The Oregon 529 plan offers a very easy way for Oregonians to invest their money for college expenses with the mission to help as many families as possible invest their money to meet their financial goals for college. In fact, one of the performance measurement goals that you require of the plan is to see the growth in the number of accounts. Oregon, like nearly all states, use mutual funds to invest as the investment vehicle and is somewhat structured like a 401k where investors can choose from a list of different investments that they want to make. However, these plans are different than 401k retirement plans in that the state must run and oversee them. Further, you cannot borrow against them and you must use the money for college-related expenses which are determined by the federal government. Because of the state's role, the public policy in helping families save and their interest as investors has always been paramount in the program. Over the years, the state has worked hard to develop a low-cost, good-performing plan with easy access. The growth in the plan shows we were successful and have been successful. Because these are self-directed investments, the state provides a variety of mutual fund choices through Oppenheimer Funds, Vanguard, and MFS, and also allows a variety of investment strategies. For example, there are age-based investment options, which are pre-mixed investment portfolios of stocks, bonds, and cash based on the age of the child. The younger the child, the greater the exposure to the stock, which has the greatest return over time and can help families grow their investments to meet the rising cost of college tuitions. The plan also has individual funds that people can invest in separately or make their own investment portfolios. Our investment options and strategies are no different than any other 529 across the country. There are really 2 ways you can open an account. There's the Drexel plan, which is offered through Oppenheimer with Vanguard Funds, where you can go online or call a toll-free number to open an account. This plan has the lowest fee structure and is the cheapest cost to invest as little as $25 a month. The other way is through a financial advisor or broker, which MFS and Oppenheimer Funds can also be purchased. Just as a little background, former State Treasurer Jim Hill had hired Strong Asset Management, a mutual fund company, to run the plan that I started on my first day of the job. The plan was a Drexel plan. Because the plan was brand new, there was a need to make Oregonians aware of it, and the contract with Strong included their commitment to market the plan statewide. Further, the contract with Strong included fee breaks for investors if a certain amount of total assets in the plan were achieved. These breaks would give more money back to investors as more money came into the plan. To expand access to the plan, the board later put out a national RFP and added a broker-sold plan through MFS, a nationally recognized mutual fund family. The name of the overall program was changed to the Oregon 529 College Savings Network to reflect this expansion. In monitoring these funds and the performance of these funds, the state has set up benchmarks to look at both the portfolios and the underlying mutual funds, and receives quarterly updates on their performance. This is industry standard, both in 529s and elsewhere. We also audit the financials of the funds every year. And Michael Parker will provide you a little more information about how we monitor in that relationship with our providers. And by the way, this plan is self-supported. I know there was some question about, is there some taxpayers' dollars at stake in running the plan? No, the plan is totally self-supported. The state collects a nominal fee to cover operational and oversight expenses. The plan administrators charge a fee to provide record keeping, administration, and investment for the plan. We have some of the lowest fees in the 529 industry. So why would you invest in a 529 plan? The Oregon plan is one of the best tax-advantaged ways for families to save for college. All capital gains are tax-free from federal and state taxes. Thanks to legislation passed last session, Oregonians now can deduct $4,000 off their state taxes. Further, the flexibility of the plan allows investors to use that money in any in-state or out-of-state, public or private, two-year, four-year, or graduate school program at any time. Again, the state has a great deal of success in getting Oregonians to invest in the plan to help them meet their goals of saving for college. We've, as I mentioned before, hit $1 billion and have more than 100,000 beneficiaries in our entire network. The program has been ranked high and is very competitive with other programs. In December of last year, we approved the addition of the first sustainable investment fund in the country to the 529 plan, and I'm extremely proud of what we've achieved over the 8 years as state treasurer. Let me briefly discuss the hiring of Oppenheimer, and I know Michael Parker, too, will add some color to this decision. During the fall of 2003, Wall Street was rocked with scandals of late trading by mutual fund companies. The CEO, Strong, was implicated, and by November 2003, we fired the company as its fate was unclear. We were the only state to fire a 529 manager in the country, although other 529 mutual fund companies had been involved in market timing. We were able to fire Strong because, like all financial managers hired by the treasurer's office, these were at-will contracts. That is, we can fire them for any cause with a 90-day out. Interestingly, many 529 plans in the country do not have that at-will provision in with their relationship and with their provider. The objective of hiring a replacement was pretty simple. We wanted, again, maintain a low-cost investment option for our participants, look at the underlying performance of the funds, making sure we had good investment options for participants, keep the plan simple, obtain a good quality age-based product as we had in the previous plan, a good mix of individual funds, maintain the high quality of customer service Strong had provided to our participants, marketing the plan successfully to increase education and awareness about 529 plans, allow flexibility for participants and the ability of the board to change the plan as needed, and Strong, as well as having Strong statewide distribution. And yes, they could not have been implicated in the current market timing scandals. We had plenty of good, we had a pretty good idea of what firms might be interested in our direct sold plans since we had been out in the market recently when we hired MFS and knew what mutual fund companies were out there. We contacted a number of mutual fund companies and three responded: Oppenheimer, UPromise with Vanguard, and MFS. We vetted the three based on the board's criteria and ultimately came to the decision to hire Oppenheimer, which provided solid mutual funds, lower fees, and a continuation of the education of Oregonians about the college savings plan. Further, we added four Vanguard funds through Oppenheimer, which were the cheapest in the country. So we got the best of both worlds. Oppenheimer is now one of the larger 529 providers and has been hired by four other states since we hired them. And Michael Parker will give you, again, more detail about the process of hiring them and why we chose them over the other providers, but let me just say the outcome was clear. We had substantially lowered the cost of the program, which would give Oregonians more of their money. We gave more investment choice to a plan, added a national recognized name, Vanguard Funds, to the program, and Oppenheimer performance had been very good over the years, and Morningstar reports confirmed that. They were one of the top-rated funds until this fall, and Oregon's program was seen as one of the better ones in the country. I handed out an article from the Wall Street Journal that notes the change that we made when we hired Oppenheimer and lists out on the backside some of the benefits of hiring Oppenheimer and what it did in providing the benefits I just laid out. So why are we here today? And I know this is the real reason why we're having this hearing. We experienced the huge underperformance of one of Oppenheimer's funds this fall, which has negatively impacted investors in the college savings plan. I'm very disappointed in what happened, and I'm sorry for those families that have been hurt by the poor performance of this fund, particularly those who were invested in the in-college portfolio, for whom protection of principal was important. The problem is, there was no warning. The core bond fund was about to lose 38% of its value in a few short months. No one saw this coming. Morningstar, which monitors mutual funds, reported on the fund's demise well after it happened. In fact, one of their analysts recently criticized the depth and complexity of the fund and what happened, quote, "the only clearly identifiable way to figure it out is to examine the fund's SEC filings and meticulously calculate cash bond, swap, future, and total return swap exposure," unquote. This core bond fund had been performing like it was supposed to and had been an integral part of our plan. In fact, it had been one of the top performing bond funds according to Morningstar and was a solid fund when we hired them in 2004. The financial meltdown on Wall Street that started in the late summer and really got going in September was extraordinary. The stock market plummeted. At year end, it dropped about 40%. And, of course, you understand the implications of that as it's affecting not only the state economy, but your budget. All investment portfolios have felt this pain, including the college savings plan. I believe the entire program, the college savings plan itself, including the Oppenheimer and Vanguard funds, is down on average about 25%. However, insult was added to injury when Oppenheimer's core bond fund values started to show underperformance during September in the in-college portfolio and in the 1 to 3 years college portfolio. Bond funds are designed to be stable and a counterbalance to stock fund gyrations. In fact, the core bond fund was a highly rated one and had performed by meeting its benchmarks and helping provide some cushion against stock market volatility. That is why when we saw this performance of the in-college and the 1 to 3 year portfolio sliding, we zeroed in on the core bond fund. To remind you, the core bond fund is about 20% of the in-college portfolio, with 40% in money market and 40% in federal bond fund, a 40% of a federal bond fund that they also run. It is about 35% in the 1 to 3 years to college. This mix, by industry standards, is conservative. However, the in-college portfolio ultimately fell 9% by year-end as a result, principally because of the poor underperformance of the core bond fund. On October 23rd, 2008, the College Savings Board and I held an emergency meeting and grilled Oppenheimer's bond fund managers. We took immediate action to understand what happened and to determine the future value of this fund. We were the only 529 plan at the time to start to dig into the problem, although others have begun as well. The fund lost value from the end of September to November. Oppenheimer told us that it would recover with improved credit markets. Based on the representations, we didn't take it out of the plan without independently understanding more about the value that was possible to recover in the fund. To that end, the board got an independent financial consultant to investigate the fund, and it did show some recovery during December. Treasurer Westland, I know, will talk to you about the board's action yesterday of removing that fund. But in mid-December, the media wrote about the fund's problems based on the Morningstar report and rightly highlighted how it was impacting those invested in the college portfolio. Michael Parker, again, will give you more detail about our monitoring of the bond fund, the fund's performance, its history, and what happened. But this I know for sure. No one saw this coming, not other investors, no other 529 plan with the fund, and not even independent researchers. Before I left the treasurer's position earlier this year, I took the following actions with the College Savings Board and with my staff, and as well made certain recommendations. We began an independent financial investigation of the bond fund to determine what to do with it. I later recommended that this fund be eliminated. We started an evaluation of each portfolio strategy to look at the risk and return profile of each investment. I believe the plan should put all of the in-college money in a money market or cash equivalent. However, there are very few plans when you look around the country that do that. It is interesting that the in-college portfolios around the country, some have not only bond exposure, but also have stock and real estate. I also requested the Attorney General's Office to conduct an investigation to determine if Oppenheimer made any misrepresentations to investors and whether the core bond fund was properly invested. That investigation is well underway. If the AG finds any wrongdoing by Oppenheimer, I have stated that the state should take appropriate action, including suing Oppenheimer for damages and termination of Oppenheimer. In fact, I spoke to the Illinois Treasurer earlier this at the beginning of the year about our AG investigation because Illinois had also hired Oppenheimer. And last Wednesday, as I said, Illinois' treasurer announced it was pursuing a lawsuit for damages. I also want to say I support the actions that were taken yesterday by the board to make changes to the plan. I think those are very positive, and again, will add value to the college savings plan. I'll leave you with this. I still believe the college savings plan is a very good way for people to save for money and for the expenses of college. The good news is, despite this problem, current investors and new investors are putting money into the plan. They have a college clock ticking in their house, like I do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Why don't we hold questions until after Mr. Parker speaks? And do you think you can do it in 5 to?
I can be very quick.
Excellent. We have a long list of people coming behind you. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. Former Treasurer Edwards covered, I think, the landscape pretty well for the committee. I'll give you a couple additional facts and just a sense of kind of where we are today as it relates to not just the core bond fund, but the entire program. And kind of a quick overview of the program now. As the former treasurer mentioned, we passed a law in 99. When we passed the law, there was no resources for us to start the program. So the legislature actually gave us a loan, as former treasurer mentioned. And in that first year, just to give you a sense of kind of the growth of the program, Oregonians were able to invest with 10,000 accounts and $33 million. So there was really a pent-up demand, I think, for college savings. I know when former Treasurer Jim Hill started the program up, we would get a lot of phone calls in the office. I didn't have that job then, but I was in the office, and folks they wanted the program to be started. They were waiting for it. And so there was a lot of pent-up demand out there. And so that showed in those first-year contributions. However, the demand got even greater. So today we're looking at about 117,000 accounts in the program and nearly $800 million. So Oregonians understand the need to save for college. They have supported this plan with their dollars, and I think that's the greatest support that you can have. And I'm really proud to report that we have an account in all 36 Oregon counties. So we don't just try to, you know, cherry pick the large counties. Our mandate by the board is to get this out to every single Oregonian, and we take that charge very seriously. So every county does have an account currently in it. And when we started the plan, you know, back in 2001, you know, the goals really were, you know, good funds, good customer service, and making sure that Oregonians have access to it. And because of that, we did get a national ranking from a national website called SavingForCollege.com with a 5-star rating out of 5 stars. And I'm proud to say that over the past 8 years, we've kept a 4.5-star rating out of that 5 stars throughout the entire program. So we've kept our high rating in these programs. Let me just touch a second on why investors are putting their money in these plans. And what we hear nationally, even from other states, and investors are using these plans really for three main reasons. One, they have good performance in the funds. But what parents really like about these plans is the tax benefits. They get the $4,000 state tax exemption, as the treasurer mentioned. They get tax-free withdrawals out of the plans. But there's one other main reason that I hear from parents all the time when I do presentations is the parents maintain control of the account. Unlike other college savings vehicles out there, when a child reaches the age of majority, the money reverts to the child. In these plans, the parents always maintain control, which is a huge feature to parents because they don't want children to get access to it without their knowledge. So that's another main reason. And really, the flexibility and control, use them for all the college expenses, you know, tuition, fees, room and board, books, any expense related to college you can use these funds for, and the ease of use. You can sign up in with our plan online in 10 minutes. Really, all we need to know is who you are, who your beneficiary is, and where you want us to invest your dollars. So very easy to use, very easy to access the money when you're ready to go to college. A simple request for distribution, the money is sent right to you. So very easy to use these programs. And I think that's key because states differ. I think it's very important to know we all are under 529, but states differ in what they can do with these plans. And so our board was very diligent in saying, look, we're going to follow the federal code, but we're not going to add additional hardships or features that don't benefit investors on these plans. So they took the tack, our board did. It's their money. Let them use it how they want. Make it easy to use, easy to get access to the money. That was kind of our mantra. So I want to kind of talk a little bit about Oppenheimer and really what services, you know, program managers provide. Now, Oppenheimer is our program manager for the Oregon College Savings. What services do they provide us? And it's not just investment management. When the law was passed, it was contemplated that we would use the private sector to set this plan up. And so not only do they do investment management for us, they do record keeping and custody, so all the records are kept with Oppenheimer. All the custody is done with Oppenheimer. All the call center, when you call up our toll-free call center, that's staffed by Oppenheimer employees. They're a distribution center for us. All the materials, all the statementing comes out from their distribution center in Denver. They do all the website management for us, and the online enrollment piece that you see, that's all done through Oppenheimer. Customer account maintenance, all that stuff is done through Oppenheimer. And then all the compliance and disclosure services, legal services like that, are done through Oppenheimer. So we contract and they provide those services for us. So it's not just that the funds are plugged in, it's all the other platform services that you see are provided through Oppenheimer. And obviously, we'll talk next about oversight, but that's those services is what we oversee, all of those services. So I just want to touch a second on oversight because that is a key to these programs. And it isn't just investment oversight. We oversee that entire contract with these firms. So we're watching everything that they do, not just investments, but everything. Our board meets quarterly, and we formally review all the activities of our program managers on a quarterly basis. So that includes investment oversight. That includes how they're talking with our customers, how they're talking with financial advisors in the community. They take that job very, very seriously, our board does, and so does staff. And just to give you an example of how detailed we get with the oversight is we instituted a year ago, we actually will get tapes and listen to call center calls. We want to know how their reps are interacting with our customers. It's very important. A lot of states do that. We just like to get a flavor of what's happening, and then we ask Oppenheimer to grade those calls, and then they grade them, and then they will train their call center reps to make them better on the phone. But we just want to get a sense of what calls are coming in and how those are being dealt with. So that's just an example of an oversight feature that we do that goes pretty deep. So just quickly, where we are today, and I will wrap up, Chair Gale, sorry, I promise. Where we are today, I mean, these are very challenging markets, and I believe personally that this plan and our plan is still in a very good position. Investors are not leaving our program. They understand markets are challenging. I think if anyone's opened up their 457 statement lately, as I have, it's fairly dim. Yes, we have a problem with core bond, which I think Oppenheimer will address as well. We have that added problem, but the markets are very challenging, and I think people understand that, and they are not running for the doors in this program. They are still investing, and we are still getting new investors every week in our program. In fact, we're averaging probably, you know, close to $1 million, $1.5 million, new dollars coming in each week in the Oregon College Savings Plan. That said, I think people are putting in a little less dollars. I mean, people have lost jobs, so less money is coming in, but new money is coming in. So I just want to give you some quick stats, and this is really kind of speaks to the performance that we've had over the last couple years. Just to give you a sense, in 2007, 97% of investors who were in the plan more than 3 years had positive earnings. So we had the plan. We've had the plan running for 8 years. So nearly all of our folks in the plan more than 3 years have had positive earnings in their plan. Even in the most challenging markets of 2008, where we've seen probably declines we haven't seen in 100 years, 76% of those folks 3 years had positive earnings in their plan. So as these plans were declining, folks still had positive earnings in this plan. And I just want to kind of leave you with that, because that's a sense of that, yes, the markets are challenging. Folks are still investing, and many folks still have positive earnings in their programs. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thanks. Are there questions? I know I have some, but I would start with you, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Parker, at the end of the day, I'm not an expert. I have four plans, got four kids. I'm not a technical expert. I'm going to rely on your office to evaluate this, the Attorney General's office to go through their investigation, and that's all fine. But on a little higher level or a different level, it is about public relations and confidence in the plan. And, you know, in the NBA, when the team's going downhill, they don't fire the players, they fire the coach. We, you know, I don't consider, you're more like the owners. You're not, you're putting your neck in.
But thank
the
you.
Program, the program managers, I think, go into that area of the head coach. Have you considered, and are you considering changing program managers?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, it's a great question, and I at the expense of stealing some of Treasurer Westland's thunder here, the board did vote yesterday to issue a national RFP for management of the Oregon College Savings Plan. So just to give you a sense, Oppenheimer's contract is up this year. We signed a five-year contract with them to manage this program for us. That program contemplates that the contract can roll if neither party wants to make a change. We felt it very important, given not just the problems they're having, but the 529 marketplace has changed dramatically over the past 5 years. There's new providers, there's new options out there. We want to avail ourselves of some of that if possible. So to answer your question, we are going to issue a national RFP for complete management of the Oregon College Savings Plan this year.
Madam
and then Treasurer Westland will speak, I think, more to that when he comes in and speaks.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you anticipating another five-year contract, or will you have a shorter term this time?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, I think it's contemplated that we sign five-year contracts. As former Treasurer Edwards mentioned, all of our contracts are at will. So, honestly, we could sign a 100-year contract and still terminate that manager on 60 days' notice.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Madam Chair, thank you. So I happen to be someone who is an individual, has an Oppenheimer TSA, and like most people, I'm just simply not opening my statements, and I'm sure they're way up, but... you know, in terms of the program's oversight, the oversight of investment, you know, there was a recent web column from Morningstar. Eric Jacobson, he has a column, The Bond Squad, and he was talking about the problems with this fund, and he is very critical of what he considers Oppenheimer's lack of transparency in what was going on with this particular fund. I just want to quote a few lines from it. He says, the only thing worse than levering up a portfolio with 180% market exposure, though, is doing it quietly. I'd like to be wrong about this, but I can't imagine that the average shareholder or advisor with a stake in these funds knew that they were leveraged in any way. And we'll probably hear more about that from the Oppenheimer people. I'd just like to ask you, you know, the can't imagine that the average shareholder or advisor, of course, we're Oregon. I would expect that our overseers are more than average. I think they're probably extraordinary. So looking back in order to look forward, do you see any way in which more scrutiny of, you know, as Treasurer Edwards mentioned, SEC reports, et cetera, could have let us know that something was going on?
Chair Gelser, Representative Dimbro, the quick answer is no. I mean, we have talked with our investment consultants at length on this. They have actually, our consultant has looked under the hood at every single security in this fund, has been doing it for the past month or so. They just got back from Boston two nights ago after sitting down with the program managers, the portfolio managers of this fund, and they are telling us that it is very difficult to express what they were doing and the reasons why these things fell. The average person, like you said, wouldn't know. As far as we're concerned, we review the portfolios on a quarterly basis. We were following our investment policy with this fund. Oppenheimer, by contract, has a duty to report to us, by contract. And so we did all the due diligence on these funds back in 2004, and the funds that we put in the program were all highly rated funds and all performing very well. If there is a material change to a fund, they have a duty to report that to the board. That's by contract. So we were following our policies and our investment policies all along the line. As Morningstar suggests, unless you are a fairly sophisticated financial analyst looking at this thing for a long time, it's very difficult to understand what was going on. And I know Oppenheimer will get into some of this of the fund, but we were following our oversight responsibilities, and it is really incumbent upon Oppenheimer, who we hire to manage the product for us, to report any changes in investment policy that any fund would have.
If I might, and furthermore, the Attorney General's office is examining whether or not they strayed too far from that. I mean, again, that's going to be determined preliminarily by them. So, and I want to just echo what Michael just said. We hire Oppenheimer, MFS, even the Vanguard funds. It is when we write that contract with these providers, it's their duty to oversee the funds as we contractually believe they were going to manage them. They do the management. They do it on a daily basis. That's how this works. And in fact, it's not just that's consistent in all 529s. It's consistent with how the Oregon Investment Council manages its portfolios of investors. You're not micromanaging the day-to-day activities. You can't. You hire them to do that, to oversee and make sure they are doing what they're supposed to. And the alignment of interest, of course, is if something goes wrong, they're in the business not to lose money, but to make money so that people are happy.
Mm-hmm. So, and just after one more quick comment, and again, I know Treasurer Westland is going to speak to this, so I won't get into it, but we are going to, I think, beef up, given the current market. Obviously, the market has, I think, changed dramatically and forever in 2008. We are going to institute some additional policies that he will speak to regarding this plan.
Mm-hmm. Can I just follow up quickly?
Quickly, yes.
So in 2004, then Oppenheimer was not, this fund was not investing in commercial mortgage-based securities and, you know, leveraging in the way. And, I mean, would you consider that then a change that you should have been notified about?
If there is deemed to be a material change, and again, I there's an investigation going on, so I don't want certainly comment. I've been instructed not to. If there was a material change, by contract, it's their duty to report that to us. So if a fund changes its investment philosophy significantly or materially, they have a duty to report that to us, to any investor.
Thank you.
There are other questions? Representative Parker.
Thank you, gentlemen, for all of the information, and Mr. Edwards for starting this up back when. I think it has served the people of the state well.
Thank you.
And I am curious about the decision by the state of Illinois to pursue the lawsuit. Do you think that the investigation there has come to a different conclusion from the same information that we have, or that they have come across additional information at this point. Maybe you can comment on that, or maybe not at this time.
And that may end up being a question to direct towards Ben Westland, who will be coming later.
It may
well
be.
I'll let you go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If I may, Madam Chair, I think I can say this. I know that the state of Oregon has, the Attorney General's office has spoken to the Illinois Attorney General's office as well, so maybe Attorney General Kroger can talk to you about that. But again, I know there's some sensitivity about what people know and when, and et cetera.
Thank you. Well, I have a couple of questions quickly that are back to the specifics of Oregon. You talked about the 97% in 07 and 76% in 08 that had positive balances in their account. How are there families in Oregon today that have less principal than they started? Have they actually lost principal? How many such families are there, and what percentage of those are individuals who are either in college or getting ready to go into college within the next 2 years?
Chair Gelser, if you would have gotten into the college savings plan sometime for the first time in 2008, you certainly will likely have lost principal because the market has declined. These plans, like any investment plan, really is designed for a longer term. So anytime you get in and out of a market or a plan or investment, you're subject to those market ups and downs. So the answer to the question is yes. If you would have gotten in middle of 2008, you certainly would see a decline in your principal balance, because you haven't had the exposure to a good market to offset the down market.
Is the down market exposure offset completely for those that invested prior to 2008? So if you have a family that invested in 2006 and they now have a student that's in college today, do any of those families have any of them lost principal?
Chair Gelser, the answer is probably potentially yes, depending on what investment option that they were in. So if you were in the money market, the answer is no. If you were in an aggressive stock fund, it could be yes. The answer could be yes. And I can dig up some those specific stats. We'd be happy to do that.
I would be really interested in knowing that the number of families that we're talking about that are in the situation. Is it 20 or is it 200? I think that would be helpful.
Happy to do that for you.
Great. And then one other question. You talked about the two different ways that a family can enter into the Oregon 529 network. Does anyone ever get paid for that? Are there any incentives from Oppenheimer or your other vendors for an investment agent or an investment broker to encourage them to buy a certain plan? And what kind of accountability is there? And have those folks made money off of encouraging families in 2008 to invest in these high-risk Oppenheimer plans? What turned out to be high-risk Oppenheimer plans?
That's a good question.
Chair Gelser, I think if what you're asking is, we have three college savings plans that we currently operate, as former Treasurer Edwards mentioned. We have the direct plan, the Oregon College Savings Plan, which you and I could just buy online or on the phone or signing an application form. The two other plans that we operate are advisor-sold plans, strictly advisor-sold plans. So the MFS plan and the Oppenheimer Funds 529 plan, you cannot buy without going through a financial advisor. And typically, as is around the country, we are not certainly the only state. Most states that have advisor plans are the same. The advisors can sell a number of different share classes in 529, what are called A, B, and C shares. If an advisor sells an A share to you in the 529 plan, the advisor gets 5% commission on the amount invested, and then a small, probably 25 basis point trail on those assets every year. That's how the advisor gets compensated for his or her work with that client.
And that's true, and not only 529.
That's
just an industry standard.
That's
brokers.
Standard across the industry.
Recognize they're also providing a broad range of service than just that one portfolio analysis. I mean, they may do your other retirement plans, and they try to help you navigate the larger complex financial world, and they get compensated for that.
But within that network of plans and those choices that the families have, is that commission consistent, or might there be a plan that incents a broker to sell that plan by offering basically a higher kickback to that person. I mean, we saw that as we talked about the high-risk mortgages that were out there, as we talked about mortgage lending reform.
Chair Gelsinger, we certainly don't do that. And you know, it would be a question you would have to ask other 529 plans if there's additional. Again, I'm not an attorney or a financial advisor, but the rules are pretty clear on what commissions can be offered. I think that would be a great question to ask Oppenheimer. They may have a great perspective on that. Here in Oregon, it's pretty clear as you sign your documents when you're working with an advisor, here's what the advisor gets paid for the work they're doing for you. The other point I will make is there's two kinds of advisors, really. There's the commission kind, which get the commission, and there's a fee advisors who maybe you work with a fee advisor. They charge you 1% on all your assets to manage your assets. They're not getting the commission. Those, we've been working with those advisors a lot. They sell the direct plan because they're working with the client holistically. And so, again, your first question, there's no additional what you would call a kickback here. It's disclosed to the investor what they pay. The advisor is required to disclose the fee to the investor when they're setting up that plan.
Thanks. And one last quick question, and then we'll move on. You had mentioned many states have 529s, and individuals can be invested in 529s from states that they don't live in. Are families from other states investing in the Oregon plan?
Yes. We do have folks from a number of states investing in our plan, and either, you know, the question is why. Well, either they like Oppenheimer and the fees we charge. We also offer four Vanguard funds in our plan, which are really very inexpensive, so they may want to take advantage of those four Vanguard funds as well. So I don't know the stats, but I would guess we would have investors from a number of other states in our plan.
Great. Thank you very much.
Could I have one more question?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sitting here thinking about my 401k, which has tanked, and I'm at the stage of life, of course, which I'm not going to be able to wait till it comes back. So what I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm trying to determine how different is a 529 from me in my 401k, or I should say my 401k. To me, it sounds very similar to the issues that I face.
Madam Chair, the answer is yes. You've decided how you want to invest money. Either you've read, either you're working with somebody to help you with managing, investing your money. Just to remind you that the portfolios we set up, particularly the age base, they're very consistent across the country. The younger the child, the more risk you take, i.e. the stock market, and the closer you get to college age, the dial down. For retirees, that's become a very popular way for people to invest for retirement. Basically, you put the money in, and you don't have to think yourself about how you want to readjust the asset allocation. They're hugely popular. So they're very parallel in that sense. And yes, and regrettably, the experience is the same. Probably the big difference, however, is we're always trying to get people to save, right, for retirement, college savings. The challenge is to get people to do something, to actually put money into doing something. That's a bigger problem in a discussion in this country, but to actually act on it. And so with the 529, your time horizon's less, right? If you start at the birth of the child, you might have 18 years. Well, a lot of people don't start saving for retirement until, well, you know, they have it either shorter or longer, depending on how disciplined they are. You have a finite amount of period of time. So, therefore, it's really important that whatever investment strategy you've taken does match that goal of the years that you think you're going to use the money. You can't go back to, you know, in your case, you could maybe continue to work, which a lot of people are going to unfortunately have to do as a result of what happened this last year.
Here I am.
But for pay.
Thank you both very much. And I know that there are individuals in the audience who may not realize your name is not on the list, but you know who you are. There are five of you, and this is for the panel to know as well. There are five people who aren't printed on the list who we still have to come before us in addition to these.
Right. Thank you for your time.
So Donna Nguyen and Kurt Wolfgruber, please. Welcome.
Thank you.
To the afternoon, and if you'll please introduce yourself for the record, and you can give your statements.
Madam Chair, good afternoon.
My name is Donna Nguyen. I am the president of OFI Private Investments, which is a subsidiary of Oppenheimer Funds, and we are the subsidiary responsible for the program management of the Oregon Savings Plan. And with you is Kurt Wolfgruber. And Kurt?
Hi, I'm Kurt Wolfgruber. I am the president and chief investment officer of Oppenheimer Funds.
Welcome.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to discuss with you our strong commitment to helping the families of Oregon invest for college. I speak for everyone at Oppenheimer Funds when I tell you that we take the trust the treasurer, the 529 board, and plan participants place in us very seriously. We understand our responsibility to the citizens of Oregon, and we are confident we have executed our duties to the plan faithfully. I will cover three topics in my comments today: our long-term success in managing the Oregon College Savings Plan and encouraging college savings, the performance of the core bond fund and related decisions made by the 529 board yesterday, and our commitment to continuing to improve on an already strong college savings plan. Since we were named program manager in February of 2004, Oppenheimer Funds has been recognized for its investment performance and its 529 program management by well-known organizations. Lipper Inc., a leading mutual fund performance ranking company, named us its Large Fund Company of the Year in 2006 and its Large Fixed Income Manager of the Year in both 2006 and 2007, based on a composite view of our fund performance relative to other similar fund companies. In 2007, Morningstar Inc. highly ranked the Oregon 529 plan. And today, the Oregon Savings Plan has a 4.5 cap rating out of 5 on savingsforcollege.com. Oppenheimer Funds has worked diligently with the board to expand and improve program offerings, as well as to lower the cost of the program. When we became the program manager, the previous average total expense ratio was 1.25%. Our expense ratio for actively managed portfolios is 30% to 75% lower. We added unaffiliated funds to the program, like Vanguard, who provides index fund options at even lower cost, 21 basis points to 47 basis points. And we continue to expand our platform, recently adding a sustainability fund to address the specific interests of Oregon residents. We have also invested significantly in efforts to educate the public on the importance of investing for college, both through direct communications and through the work of our local sales force, which works closely with financial advisors on how to help their clients in this important area. Our efforts, in conjunction with those of the board and the treasurer's office, have created a plan that is achieving its goal of encouraging more Oregonians to save for college. Since we became program manager, both assets in the plan and the number of accounts have tripled. At the end of 2008, Oregonians had more than $300 million earmarked to pay for college and invested in a tax-managed plan than they did at the start of 2004. As you may know, yesterday, the board voted to remove Oppenheimer Core Bond Fund and the Oppenheimer Limited Term Government Fund from various portfolios in the Oregon 529 plan based on concern about the future management and recent performance of those funds. As a firm and as individuals who invest in those funds, we were disappointed by the performance of those funds last year and are directly familiar with the pain it caused investors. We do not want to lose the business, but we understand the board's decision. We will continue to work diligently with the board and treasurer in all aspects of our management of the program and the underlying funds. I want to assure the committee that the funds were managed in accordance with their investment guidelines, using securities appropriate for their objectives. And in fact, the consultant who spoke to the board yesterday reinforce that. Based on historical returns, the only measure we have available to us, we believe they were an appropriate investment in the various portfolios in which they were used in the plan. As was also reported at the board meeting, the Attorney General's office is reviewing these funds used in the plan. We will cooperate fully and expect there be no findings of impropriety. Looking ahead, we are working closely with the board to support their efforts to enhance the plan. In particular, we are working to address the specific interests of Oregonians with an all-index age-based investment track, guaranteed funds, a sustainability fund, and, if legislation passes, a prepaid tuition plan. On the prepaid plan legislation introduced by Senate President Courtney, we join the Treasurer and the Board in supporting its passage, as we believe it can be an excellent complement to an investment plan. We remain committed to working with the Board to evaluate our reporting to ensure that we continue to provide meaningful data in a manner and time frame that allows the Board to execute its duties effectively. And we will continue the discussion begun yesterday with the board and its consultants about the structure and naming of funds within the plan. We have hired an independent investment consultant to study the asset allocation of portfolios in the plan, and we will make adjustments based on the board's acceptance of any recommendations coming from the study. We have already taken the initial steps to launch our National College Saver Advocacy Platform. On behalf of all of our 529 College Savings Plan clients, we have initiated an extensive research and education program that we expect to help investors across the country, and specifically in Oregon, understand the many challenges to funding a college education and provide the first ever product-neutral online clearinghouse for information on all aspects of financing a college education. In closing, we recognize, as I believe the Board and Treasurer Westland do, that the most important goal we have is to create a plan that will encourage Oregonians to invest for college and increase access to higher education. We will continue to make every effort to create such a plan and to ensure that the right way to invest is more than just a slogan for the people of Oregon. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I do not have any prepared remarks. I made a very lengthy testimony yesterday afternoon, but I'm sure, given the questions that have already been asked, there will be some that relate to the investment portions of core bond and other investments. So I'd be happy to take any questions, either both of us would.
Great. Thank you. I have some questions, but I would entertain yours first. Oh, that means no?
Have at it.
Well, thank you. One of the things that I have been wondering, and I think Representative Van Orman referenced this, we know that the stock market in the fall, our financial markets have plummeted. The bottom fell out. Nobody could predict where we would be today. I think that's without question. What I'd like to better understand, though, is why did the Oppenheimer funds fall so far compared to everybody else? What was so different about this fund, particularly given that this was an ultra-conservative fund?
Madam Chair, I'll respond to that. The comments you started with and that were made by Representative Van Orman, I think, reflect the market environment where, indeed, in 2008, there almost was no escape other than Treasury securities. And I'll just remind you, what would be the most conservative investment one might make would probably be money market funds. You may not know, but over a third of all money market funds over the past year or two have had to be bailed out in terms of rescue of one form or another. So there was really no escape in terms of the financial difficulty in the markets. Paradoxically, our team that invested in the core bond fund actually got it quite right towards the later part of 07 by thinking that the economy was about to weaken, certainly not the degree to which it has, but and moving towards what they viewed to be a much more high-quality profile of their portfolio. The core bond fund invests in a broad range of fixed income instruments, domestic and foreign corporate bonds, government bonds, mortgage-backed securities, those that are directly offered, as well as those from agencies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. As I said, towards the end of 2007, with that view, they really felt they ought to be focusing on higher-grade investments that would benefit better or perform better than those lower quality securities as the economy weakened. And they did start to make significant investments in principally commercial mortgage-backed securities. These were AAA rated securities, and they are today AAA rated securities. The second thing that they did was they moved towards corporate bonds of high quality corporations. You'll get the idea here, though, the first effort was towards financial institutions. And to some degree, that proved to be successful, because in the second quarter of 2008, when Bear Stearns, you all may remember, was absorbed into J.P. Morgan, there was a considerable rally in both commercial mortgage-backed securities and the corporate debt of major banks, thinking that the too-big-to-fail argument was prevalent in our market. And, of course, we all know at that point things went the other way. And as the market proceeded through 2008, the pressures escalated principally around two events. One, the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, which of course threw the too-big-to-fail idea right out the window, and that hurt a number of those corporate bond investments. More importantly, and by far and away the larger negative impact, was from the commercial mortgage-backed securities market, which I think, if I were to reflect back, we should have been more concerned about who else owned them than the quality investments we had, because they were very substantial investments of the large banks and brokerage institutions who, after the Lehman bankruptcy and as we moved through September, October, and November, were under tremendous pressure in their own balance sheets. They were selling those securities and or trying to hedge them in such a way that, while they are mortgage-backed securities, senior, as I said, AAA-rated, what are called senior subordinated, they were trading at prices that reflected 100% default rates, meaning the assumption that every one of them would default and that you would get a recovery ultimately as low as about 20%. So the reflection that the trading, the downward pressure from the banks and other financial institutions really impacted them dramatically. To give you another way of thinking about that, over a long period of history, the spread or the additional yield that we all would earn from one of these securities was typically about 1% relative to treasuries. Early in 2008, that got to 1.75%, and at the time of the Bear Stearns bankruptcy was about 4.75%. So reflected a very high spread relative to history. The second quarter, as I said earlier, occurred. We had a rally. It looked good. But by November 20th, that spread had moved to 15.6%. An unprecedented level, as I said, that assumed 100% default rates. The second element of that occurred, it was alluded to earlier also about the Treasury bills. At a time when everyone was even leaving money market funds to go into bank CDs because they feared money market funds, you also had a correlation of virtually every type of what you'd normally think of in a fixed income fund, any diversifying asset, such that the only asset that was appreciating in that period were direct obligations of the U.S. government or treasuries. So the correlations of what we thought was a much more diversified portfolio went way up. And then the third piece that I mentioned was the underperformance of the corporate bonds. Last part I should mention is liquidity. Virtually in those days, even as we looked at those portfolios at that time and tried to go to the marketplace to change some of the underlying investments, the ability to do that in the marketplace was virtually nil. Now, we have had a fairly substantial, as former Treasurer Edwards mentioned, recovery in some of those in the latter part of in December and early January, and that could continue. It's been about 16% or 17%. But we still have a long road to go with regard to those assets and their recovery.
And I guess another question that I would have, and I think this was touched on in the board hearing yesterday, the investors in this plan are families. Many of them, this may be the only thing that they're investing in. They aren't necessarily investment savvy. Their focus is saving money so that their kids can go to school. And I think many of those folks who are especially close to enrollment are very interested when they see something that's called ultra-conservative. And I know that what my idea as a mother of four of ultra-conservative is something that's very, very safe, something that I can count on, and something that isn't put at a tremendous risk. Is there a different definition of ultra-conservative out there that doesn't match mine and perhaps those families who have made these investments?
Let me first, Madam Chair, respond that core bond would probably be a small sleeve in something defined in that nomenclature, and that is used. It's not necessarily our words or others, but the words conservative, ultra-conservative, moderate, et cetera, have been used historically to represent a series of investments that historically display particular characteristics. And I should point out, even the core bond fund, the five previous years that had been managed by the team, had never had a down year. In fact, it had only had one down quarter of about 2%, and it had done substantially better than all of its peers in the business. So it had displayed very consistent, high level of returns in those prior years. I guess now, though, important issue is looking forward, that the element of performance of underlying securities, even AAA mortgage-backed securities, and what they are, has been redefined. 2008 will change the way any of that gets incorporated into expectations of future risk or future return. Believe me, I feel the pain. I have three children in college. I have investments in a number of Oppenheimer funds, and core bond is one of the more significant ones. It is one of my fixed income allocations to save for that, and as well as other things. So we certainly will embed that in the way we think about that fund and others in the future, and I think we all will have a year of unfortunate experience that hopefully will make us better investors in the future.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I just ask a question? Thank you. So going back to the ultra-conservative, you know, for me, when I think of something that's ultra-conservative, something I think of it as something that I want on a kind of holding pattern before, you know, just before I'm about to tap into it, right? So I'm... Okay, there's a part of me, I admit, that really would love to see it going way up. But I know I don't want to be thinking that. You know, rather, it should be at a kind of sustainable level before I start making withdrawals. So what do you think, I mean, what should we be thinking of as a reasonable rate of return for something that's on hold just before it's needed to be used?
Yeah.
And were we perhaps... as a nation, you know, too optimistic about what we wanted to see happen? That is, we, on the one hand, were we saying that we want to be conservative, but we didn't really want to be conservative? Or, I don't know, this may be a little too philosophical, but if you could sort of talk about that.
I'll give it a try, Madam Chair, Representative Dembro. It's certainly what we typically think of in our world as a risk-free rate is U.S. Treasuries. And then we think from there around a profile or a pattern of return that might be within the level of expectations. And I think in your world of ultra-conservative, we all probably have our own opinion. I would probably have whatever that Treasury bill return is, plus or minus 2 or 3%. That would probably be my guess. Understanding that a standard or an expected deviation from that might be 2 or 3% more on either side of that. For sure, over the last decade, prior to 2008, we probably did as a society get pretty, complacent about what we thought levels of returns could likely be and what levels of risk we ought to take. I will point out income is a component of that, too. And as you know, today, Treasury bills are paying about 0.1, depending on the length, or maybe 0.75%. So certainly the perspective of earning income, again, and albeit in a AAA-rated security, and these mortgage-backed securities typically have durations of about two years, meaning that a 100% change in interest rates would cause about a 2% fluctuation normally in its value. So these are not, in a historical sense, highly risky securities. But income does play a role there, too, in terms of how you do it. So if your objective is to earn no real return, simply put the money, then you start with a savings account and move up. I'm sure I haven't answered it because it is a long philosophical argument, embedded, obviously, in historical information that we all base these estimates on.
Thank you. And Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late. I had other things I had to get started on this afternoon, but I did get here for the end of the testimony of the former treasurer and of the executive director of the college savings plan. And I would note that there seems to be a real difference in an understanding, I guess, of the of the operation of the particular plan that we're talking about. And I don't plan to ask you any questions about that because I know that's a subject which may be maybe connected with litigation or at least the contemplation of that. But I did want to ask you about the description that you gave, very vivid description you gave of what happened last year after the end of the second quarter and the times that those assets were sort of unwinding. And it sounded to me as though you were really kind of describing a financial implosion and a development of a financial panic where people were unloading assets which had real value at far less than their real value because of their need for liquidity at that time. Is that a reasonable characterization, at least of part of what you were describing?
Yes, Representative Barnhart, I believe that exactly to be the case.
Okay. And then you said, you indicated that, if I may, Madam Chair, you indicated that in answer, I think, to Representative Dembrough's question, you indicated that you think that this situation that we have just recently lived through, which certainly didn't originate with your company, it originated with the entire economy, a much larger situation, would redefine what conservative meant. Do you have any further thoughts that you might give us about what you believe at this point that term may come to mean in light of this experience for this generation?
Well, again, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think first it would be just a reassertion of financial markets. One, there never being a guarantee, and two, that, and it's famous, I know, the Black Swan, if any of you read it, that completely unexpected events can and will happen, particularly in this world. So that I believe it will just be a recognition of risks in financial instruments that has been lacking in evidence for a better part of a decade, that has come home to roost in the midst of a very, very significant economic change and challenge that certainly adds a level of uncertainty. Investments, when there is certainty regarding cash flows, get very clouded when the economy takes on a lot of uncertainty. And so people begin, as you know, emotions make their way into pricing. So that's really, I think, it's a new recognition of the range of outcomes that people should expect that can happen.
And a final,
yes,
if I may. Based on what I read in the papers and learned from other people, my suspicion is that a very large number of financial people who operate regularly in the financial markets did not really understand the import of what you just said at the end of the second quarter last year.
Yes, Representative Barnhart. It's the other piece of or occurrence that I failed to mention earlier was that as the recovery, as the TARP plan, the troubled asset plan, was developed, initially it was developed in order to provide support to asset-backed securities, including mortgages. It was a key component. And on November, I've forgotten the exact date, I think it was the 18th, Treasury Secretary Paulson decided to announce not to do that. And I didn't mention, in case of Representative Dembrough, your question earlier, virtually 90% of the underperformance of core bond fund relative to its peer group median, and I think former Treasurer Edwards mentioned this earlier, occurred in the September to November period. And the vast majority of that was in November, particularly the 3 days that immediately succeeded Treasury Secretary Paulson's announcement. So there certainly was. Yes, it started with subprime, and I want to make it clear, there were no investments in this fund in subprime mortgages. These were AAA, but certainly the contagion that started with subprime made its way through into other assets and ultimately into institutions who eventually had to sell them and put tremendous pressure on them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Norman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This brings up to mind, too, is that I don't think we can overlook the subpar performance of the Securities Exchange Commission in overseeing this? A comment, not a question.
Thank you both very much for coming today to offer your testimony. Next up, we have Bill Humphreys. And
thank
if you'll
you.
Just introduce yourself for the record, okay. Like your orange tie.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Bill Humphreys. I'm the president and CEO of Citizens Bank Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm here at the request of the chair. As a result of an email that I sent to her after reading an article in the newspaper about the extent of the losses in this plan. To sort of paraphrase my email, I just feel strongly that this didn't need to happen. In my business, and you've heard a lot of negative press about banks as well, but it didn't need to happen in the banking industry either. We've talked about our own personal 401k plans here today, and I would share with you that I haven't had a loss in my 401k plan. It's at a positive number and has been consistently so. Our bank has not had an investment loss in its investment portfolio. Our investment portfolio has shown consistent returns, positive returns. Right now, quite a market gain. So it doesn't need to happen, really. And it really gets down, for me, it gets down to making choices about risk. And we heard the former treasurer a few minutes ago talk about balancing a choice about which fund to invest in, but he emphasized really return on the fund, and he emphasized accessibility and choice, but he didn't talk a lot about risk and risk mitigation measures that are built into a policy. And frankly, I believe that if you start with a real strong investment policy, which we have in our bank and I have personally, you talk about ultra-conservative. Well, you know, you don't know ultra-conservative around here. I'm very my picture's in the dictionary next to the but you start with a very strong investment plan that has real tight risk mitigation measures built into it. And then you have an oversight board that insists that the plan is followed. And then you make selections about investment that don't allow the risk level to be taken that was taken. And maybe the problem or the error was made in investing in Oppenheimer funds in the first place. They're a fund. They're going to manage their fund in accordance with the risk elements that are built into that fund. They're going to do their best, unless they cheat in some way or make some decisions that are fraudulent. They'll manage the fund according to the plan of the fund. That level of risk will be taken and losses will be made, certainly in this kind of a marketplace. We also heard that there was good oversight, but quarterly meetings, in my business, if you have a quarterly meeting by the board and you wait to hear the bad news or see the downtrends or whatever, you generally end up going another quarter to see the results of whatever action you take from the result of the news of that meeting. So you're really sort of 6 months into the deal, and in this marketplace, 6 months is real, real slow response. So, we try to get out ahead of it. We try to proactively manage risk. We try to mitigate every risk possible. We settle for less return. And our focus is the return of the principal is more important than the return on the principal. So that's my comments.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Humphreys? Thank you so much for making the drive up today.
Okay.
And so next up we have, I'm going to go ahead and call three of you up at the same time, Mr. Bob Goodell, Carol Almquist, and Catherine Cleland. Please. maybe. I guess there are only two chairs.
Should we pull up a...
Here, can you pull up a third?
You can pull up a third.
Oh, good. They're, I think they're hooked together. why don't you take it? Oh, they freed a chair.
Absolutely.
It's been released from captivity. Thank you all so much for coming. And as you begin your statement, if you could just state your name and where you're from for the record, that would be very helpful.
Hi, I'm Catherine Cleland. I'm from Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm a working mom. Education is a very fundamental value in our family. I'm one of those folks who started saving for college for my kids the month they were born. We were one of the first investors into the Oregon 529. We were there within 3 months of its opening. We were in the strong, rode through that, went into Oppenheimer, have seen the Oppenheimer changes. I'm a savvy individual investor, is how I characterize myself. I am not a financial expert. I don't follow financial markets, but I am a consumer of financial savings plans. And I want to read to you from my 2005. So when I talked to Sarah, I pulled out my portfolio, and I keep files on all of my investments, like a good consumer should. And this is from the perspective for Oppenheimer bond funds on 1/21/05, which is when the last time I made a distribution decision on how to distribute and invest, because this was the year and the month that we started doing monthly savings rather than annual savings, because we knew college was coming. And under the conservative portfolio, it reads, objective, invest primarily in bond and money market investments in order to seek the portfolio's objectives of income and protection of principal. This portfolio seeks preservation of capital with minimal growth by investing primarily in bond underlying funds to maintain stability. In this fund, it was 35% in the Oppenheimer Core Bond Fund. And that was for a 1 to 3 years enrollment to college. Well, I didn't choose that fund, and I'm very glad. The fund I chose was called the Balance Fund, which was only 30% in the Core Bond Fund. But that 30% of my portfolio that was in that Core Bond Fund has made the college savings for my daughters go down between the two portfolios, $15,000, and I believe at least $4,000 of that is due to the Core Bond Fund's drop of the significant amount it did. So we're looking at now a very difficult time for planning for college for the two girls.
Thank you, Catherine. Are there questions for Ms. Cleland? Thank you. Mr. Goodell.
I'm Bob Goodell, retired.
Mr. Goodell, if you could sit down so that the microphone picks it up for the record.
Or I feel comfortable standing, please.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Catherine.
This won't take more than a minute. Barbara and I started to invest 6 years ago, $2,000 a year. Last year we put in $4,000. So we have a total of $16,000 in the fund. I got a statement that said it's worth $14,000. It had risen from $16,000 to $19,000, so we lost $5,000. We'd have been better off to put that $16,000 in the mattress. It would be there today, worth $16,000, except it's only worth $14,000. For this plan to go from 8th to 42nd place in the United States in less than a year speaks for itself. I think it speaks partly towards poor management. I think it's important for this committee to look into the qualifications of the people who are looking after almost $1 billion worth of funds. Do these people have an adequate background, credential-wise, in financing, in investment, in the stock market, in the business world? If they're put there based on political expediency, God help us. We may only be one small family out of 70,000, but this is what we're going to do this year. We are not investing in the plan. Secondly, if our next statement doesn't show an improvement, we're going to roll it over into New York or Louisiana, which are currently one in first and second place in the nation. And third, if there's a class action suit, we'll have signed it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for coming. Ms. Onquist.
Thank you for inviting me to come today. For the record, my name is Carol Onquist, and I live in West Salem. I'm the grandmother of two children who will be enrolling in college within the next decade, And I am here as a concerned grandparent. Upon advice, I have been investing funds in the Oregon College Saving Plan for several years. And when I did, this seemed a perfect opportunity to put a few dollars away to help our grandchildren when the time came for them to seek higher education. My late husband and I had set this as a personal goal because we wanted to have some participation in our grandchildren's education. Besides, there was a nice tax credit advantage for us. Now, in our family, education has always been very important. The recent news about the slide of the Oregon College Savings Plan was very disconcerting. So now I'm faced with, what do I do? Do I continue investing in the 529 here in Oregon? Do I go someplace else and put these college savings monies away? Undoubtedly, there are other grandparents like me facing the same concerns. Now, I'm very thankful my grandchildren aren't enrolling in college tomorrow because I have a few more years. But I can't emphasize or underscore enough the concern that I have about the plan. And I want to thank you in conclusion for convening this forum so we can speak our minds. And I appreciate your listening to my concerns and my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for our witnesses? Thank you very much for coming and sharing your stories with us today. So next up we have the Attorney General, John Kroger.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. With me is Keith Dubanovich, who's special counsel at the Department of Justice. I will be very brief today. We obviously take the events that we've been hearing about and that this committee has been inquiring into very seriously. And so I just wanted to give the committee in its oversight role a brief update about where the state is at with its investigation. I was sworn in on January 5th, and that day I consulted with our new treasurer, Ben Westland. Previous to January 5th, Randall Edwards had requested that the Oregon Department of Justice begin an investigation into these matters. I confirmed on that day with the new treasurer that he wanted to proceed with that investigation. We brought our senior team that's supervising the case together. I authorized the investigation to continue, and we made some basic decisions about the direction we'll be heading. The investigation is being conducted both by our own attorneys at the Oregon Department of Justice as well as outside counsel, who we have deputized in order to make sure that we have all the expertise to do a very rapid investigation. We are in contact with three other states who are positioned not necessarily with identical facts, but with similar facts relating to Oppenheimer: Illinois, New Mexico, and Maine. And all three states are coordinating to the extent we can our investigation. And should we at some time determine that it's appropriate to have unified legal action, then we will certainly take that step. The focus of our investigation, our primary focus, is into whether Oppenheimer has violated any federal securities law, any state law, or breached any fiduciary duties to the investors in the plan. In cases like this, those kind of violations typically stem from either some kind of material misrepresentation to investors about what they could expect, a material omission, a failure to disclose some information that would have been important to investors, or some other action that might breach their fiduciary duties to the investors. It is too early at this stage to give anyone any advice as to the direction this investigation will be heading. I know from experience it's always a mistake to prejudge an investigation until you've concluded. I can tell you that there's likely to be one of two outcomes. Either the state will seek through some form of legal action to try to regain some of the value lost by investors, or we will make a recommendation not to pursue litigation, either because there is no valid claim or we believe our chances of success on a potential claim are relatively weak. I wish I could give both the committee and the citizens who care about this deeply some sense of our timing. I also know from personal experience that you really cannot judge in the early phases of an investigation how quickly or slowly they will take. It depends a lot on the quality of the information one receives and what's contained in that information. Sometimes these things can be wrapped up extraordinarily quickly. Sometimes they become incredibly complex and convoluted, and it takes you a while to sort things out until you can make a proper legal judgment. I can tell you that it is a very high priority, I'm sure, of the Treasurer, but also of the Department of Justice, and we are going to be moving as fast as we possibly can to make sure that we take all the appropriate steps. Finally, I just want to say that we do have a very good team working on this, I can assure you, and the investigation is going to be fair, it's going to be professional, and it's going to be as swift as we can possibly conduct. And with that, as you might imagine, I don't really wish to discuss facts about the status of the investigation, but I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair, that you or committee members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Representative Van Orman.
Mr. Attorney General, it's nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Thank you. And my question is there any involvement of the federal government in this issue?
That is a fantastic question. As far as I know, sitting here today, there is not currently a Securities and Exchange Commission review. I think what we would like to do is conduct at least the preliminary stages of our investigation. If we feel that that reveals something that needs to be brought to the attention of federal authorities, we will certainly take that step. As we're sitting here today, I don't know of any federal inquiry, but I can tell you from experience, I'm not sure if there was SEC involvement right now, or they're beginning to look at these facts. I'm not sure if we would know it. I do know that given all the events over the last 3 or 4 months, that they're probably very busy.
Thank you.
Are there other questions from the panel? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I think I know the answer to this one, Mr. Attorney General, but I'll ask it anyway. I assume that as you proceed through your investigation and conclude your case in whatever form that happens to come out, if you come across issues that you think the legislature should address from a policy point of view or from the point of view of the authority of your office or the authority of the state treasury, you will let us know.
You know, I certainly see my mission here as very much focused on whether there have been violations of the law, and I'm sure you understand that as our focus. Certainly, I would be happy to provide any insights that we might receive as a result of our inquiry with the committee. But I you know, very much want to emphasize that you know, general government oversight or recommendations about how things perform isn't truly our function here, that what we are very much focused on is what I think the investors in this fund would be most interested that I focus on, and that's whether there are any violations of the law and any possibility that we can get some recourse.
Great. And just simple, a statement as a matter of follow-up. I completely agree that that ought to be your focus. But as you do the work, you're going to learn a lot about what actually happened and what the issues are that came up. And in that process, you may come across things that we should know more about.
I'm sure that may be the case, and as we're at the point of making some decisions about how the investigation is going to terminate, I'd be happy to come back before the committee and discuss the direction that we're headed. I'm also, you know, positive that those kind of inquiries and considerations from a policy perspective are being conducted by the Treasury, and
yes.
They've got a lot of expertise in this area. So we'll certainly try to add what perspective we can.
I'm convinced of that, too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you very much.
Treasurer Westland, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. For the record, I am Oregon State Treasurer Ben Westland. And as an aside, I will point out that this is the first time I have had the privilege to testify to a legislative committee. And so I am honored to be here and very thankful that you gave me this opportunity.
Mr. Treasurer, welcome to the legislature. We miss you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for convening this important committee and discussion about Oregon's 529 College Savings Networks, the program that really has been a valuable tool to thousands of Oregonians and their families, and it is one way that Oregon can help make college more accessible and more affordable. Please know that one of my top priorities, a goal I know you, Madam Chair, and the entire committee share, is to make Oregon's college savings access and affordability model the absolute best in the country. A part of that modeling, the Oregon College 529 Savings Plan, demands our immediate attention and action. And so, again, as a top priority, since I've taken office 15 short days ago, I see my role as the state's chief fiduciary officer and in that capacity to protect Oregon's assets and Oregonians' assets to the best of my office's ability. Yes, certainly, participants in the Oregon College Savings Plan, including myself and my family, have seen dramatic declines during this past catastrophic year on Wall Street. But those declines in and of themselves do not mitigate in any way our obligation to ensure that possible questionable investment practices did not make those losses worse. At the request of former Treasurer Randall Edwards, the Attorney General has launched a comprehensive investigation into the handling and management of certain mutual funds that are part of that portfolio. I certainly support and will continue to support that investigation. Yeah. More than that, and as a result of some of these dramatic losses, I'm here to testify as to the swift action we are taking to make this program as whole and renew confidence in the plan as we go forward. Now, this week I announced that I will restructure the investment division at the Office of State Treasurer to take a bigger role in providing analysis, due diligence, and oversight for the College 529 Savings Plans. Yesterday, the Oregon 529 Board took a series of significant steps to strengthen the Oregon 529 College Savings Network, increase the board's oversight, and increase, importantly, and I think this should be one of our guiding stars as we all go forward, increase choices for Oregon families. We, as a board action yesterday, terminated two funds, not just the core bond fund that we hear primarily about, but also the limited duration government bond fund. We have provided new choices in that we are adding to the portfolio mix a new age-based index fund. We are seeking requests for proposals. We've issued the RFP for the plan administrator you know, we need to survey the market and see if we are getting the best deal for Oregon families. As a timing issue, I will tell you that contract is up in December. The date that we are, quote, officially required to let out the RFPs is August. We decided to let this out early so we can do as comprehensive a review as early as possible. There will be additional oversight. The board will meet monthly. It's always scheduled to meet quarterly, and you know, during this time and until we get through it, I think the board has to be very responsive, very nimble in addressing these issues. The board overwhelmingly supported that. And again, like most boards in this state, they are peopled by volunteers committed to their community. It truly is a role of public service. So I was very pleased with that board support. And the board supported a resolution to the legislature in support of prepaid tuition for families that are more risk-averse, or those wishing to take no risk, you know, as a better way to save. You know, it is time that, as we go forward, you know, we look at a larger model, a larger picture on how to improve our access and affordability programs. And we have the shared responsibility. We have the 529. We have various other programs. But I think there will be ideas that come forth through the, you know, legislative process, this great cauldron of creativity. And as we go forward, Madam Chair, I look forward to working closely with you as we all, again, the goal, create the best college affordability and access model in the country. That is our goal. Our children deserve no less. Our state deserves no less. This is all of our obligation, and I know we all very willingly accept it. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. No questions for the Treasurer? Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, I can't pass this up. A cauldron of creativity? I thought it was like making sausage, right?
You know, and at the end of the day, for all the critiques and criticisms, you know, we take, it is a, you know, don't watch the sausage being made. But at the end of the day, really, it's a pretty edible product. So it's not that we don't make mistakes. It's not that everything's perfect. It's not that we don't stub our toe. But, you know, at the end of the day, this legislature really is a place where people come to vision, create, you know, all to improve the quality of life for all Oregonians. So it's a good thing this is a cauldron of creativity. It's also a cauldron of other things, but we won't go there.
I accept that.
Well, thank you. So, Representative Thatcher.
Hey, thank you, Chair Grassley. Something stood out to me from earlier testimony. I think it was Bill, I don't know, Humphreys with Citizens Bank, Corvallis. He was mentioning quarterly meetings. Like, that's just not a, you know, sufficient amount of oversight or meeting to get something done. Is it within your purview to make those meetings or reviews sooner rather than sticking with just that quarterly?
Chair Gelter, Representative Thatcher, the short answer to your question is yes. Part of this, again, we've increased the meeting time 400% is really what we've done. So, but it is within the purview of the chair to call an emergency meeting, you know, at any given time. Part of this is an information flow issue. You know, we don't have really any additional information that would drive, you know, the calling of a meeting right now. You know, having said that, there are processes underway in terms of letting of the RFP, merging part of the oversight into Oregon's just incredibly accomplished investment division. There are things that are ongoing as we, quote, sit here and wait for the next, quote, regularly scheduled meeting. But if, you know, something arises that requires more immediate attention, we can do that instantly.
Thank you. Good to hear.
Thank you, Representative Dimbrough.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Treasurer, welcome. Just to follow up on that question, you mentioned earlier that you're initiating some steps to reorganize the department to have enhanced oversight, which would perhaps trigger one of those emergency meetings if necessary. Could you go into more detail about what your plans are for how you're going to go about creating more oversight?
Well, as an additional layer, in addition to the contract requirements, when we let these contracts to the various quote managers, in addition to our consultant that also looks at these investments, what I'm doing right now, currently this is happening as we speak, it's a little bit of a misnomer to say we're reorganizing the Oregon's investment division, but we are weaving into their investment division decision-making and due diligence formula, to put their eyes on the paper and the numbers as well, something they do every day in a very professional capacity.
Madam Chair.
Representative Van Orman first, and then Representative Mack.
Madam Chair, Mr. Treasurer, it's good to see you too. Is the makeup of the board defined by statute?
The makeup of the board, I believe, this is an I believe, is defined by statute.
Okay, so I could look it up and find out.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The program manager, is there or should there be no conflict between the program manager's role and subordinate funds that are in that? In this case, Oppenheimer's program manager, and then you have Oppenheimer funds in the plan. Is that at all a question that should be reviewed? I don't know the answer to that.
Representative Geltzer, or Chair Geltzer, Representative Maurer, let me back up half a second to Representative Van Orman's question. Let me put it this way. I cannot imagine that defined by statute that the board members, selection process is not defined by statute. This is a creation of, cauldron of creativity. This is a creation of the legislative process.
Okay.
So I just can't imagine. The answer to your question, Representative Maurer, is the relationship between fund manager or the overall manager and the fund managers, it's one of the things we're looking at as we go forward. I can't speak legally to that relationship in the past, but the answer is I do believe that is, an appropriate function, and that's one of the reasons we're including another layer of oversight into this whole decision-making process.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming to our cauldron today. Thank you to all of our panels that came and shared your thoughts today. Obviously, this is just one of many conversations we'll have about all aspects related to higher education and affordability. And one of the things that's weighing heavily on my mind as we're listening, particularly to the parents and the grandparents that talked about their investments, is the information that was brought to us at our last meeting from our college presidents and the vice chancellor, and about the loss of students in times of economic uncertainty. So while helping people save for college, the opportunity grants is part of it, continuing to be 44th, 45th in the nation in our investment and core support for higher education is something that is the real problem that we really need to be stepping up to address. So thank you all for coming today to share your thoughts. I'm sure we'll be discussing this again. We'll see you all on Monday, and the House Education Committee is adjourned. Mm-hmm.